50.
The passion for God. There are sincere, peasant, pushy types like Luther's. All Protestantism lacks the southern delicatezza, delicacy. There is an oriental way of moving outside oneself, as with a slave who, without deserving it, has been blessed or ennobled. For example, Augustine, who lacks in an offensive way all nobility of gestures and desires. There is some feminine tenderness and desire in it which pushes itself bashfully and ignorantly towards a unio mystica et physica, a mystical and physical union, as with Madame de Guillon. Strangely enough, in many cases, it appears as a disguise for puberty in a young woman or man, and here and there even as the hysteria of an old spinster, also as her last ambition. In such cases, the Church has often already declared the woman a saint. 51. Up to now, the most powerful people have always bowed reverently before the saint as the riddle of self-conquest and of intentional final sacrifice. Why did they bow? They sensed in him, and, so to speak, behind the question mark of his frail and pathetic appearance, the superior power which wished to test itself in such a victory, the strength of the will, in which they knew how to recognize and honor their own strength and pleasure in mastery once more. They were honoring something in themselves when they revered the saint. It got to the point that the sight of a saint aroused a suspicion in them. Such a monster of denial, something so contrary to nature, would not have been desired for no reason. That's what they said and questioned themselves about. Perhaps there is a reason for that. A really great danger about which the ascetic, thanks to his secret comforters and visitors, could provide more precise information. In short, the powerful people of the earth learned from the saint a new fear. They sensed a new power, a strange and as yet unconquered enemy. It was the will to power which compelled them to halt in front of the saint. They had to ask him. 52. In the Jewish Old Testament, the Book of Divine Justice, there are men, things, and speeches of such impressive style that the world of Greek and Indian literature has nothing to place beside them. We stand with fear and reverence before these tremendous remnants of what human beings once were, and will in the process suffer melancholy thoughts about old Asia and its protruding peninsula of Europe, which, in marked contrast to Asia, wants to represent the progress of man. Naturally, whoever is in himself only a weak, tame, domestic animal, and who knows only the needs of domestic animals, like our educated people nowadays, including the Christians of educated Christianity, among these ruins such a man finds nothing astonishing or even anything to be sad about. A taste for the Old Testament is a touchstone with respect to great and small. Perhaps he finds the New Testament, that book of grace, still preferable to his heart. In it there is a good deal of the really tender, stifling smell of over-pious and small-souled people. To have glued together this New Testament, a sort of rococo of taste in all respects, with the Old Testament into a single book, as the Bible and the essential book, that is perhaps the greatest act of daring and sin against the spirit, which literary Europe has on its conscience. 53. Why atheism today? The Father in God has been fundamentally disproved, as well as the judge, the rewarder. Together with his free will, he is not listening, and if he did hear, he wouldn't know how to help anyway. The worst thing is this. He appears incapable of communicating clearly. Is he indistinct? From a number of different conversations, asking and listening, this is what I have unearthed as the cause of the decline of European theism. It seems to me that the religious instinct is, in fact, growing powerfully, but that it is rejecting, with profound distrust, theistic satisfaction. 54. When you get down to it, what is all recent philosophy doing? Since Descartes, and in fact more in defiance of him than on the basis of what he had done before, all philosophers are trying to assassinate the old idea of the soul under the appearance of a critique of the idea of the subject and predicate. That means an attempt to kill the basic assumption of Christian teaching. More recent philosophy, as an epistemological scepticism, is, in a concealed or open manner, anti-Christian, although, and this is said for more refined ears, in no way anti-religious. Formerly, that is, people believed in the soul as they believed in grammar and the grammatical subject. One said, I is the condition, think is the predicate and conditioned. Thinking is an activity for which a subject must be thought of as cause. Now people tried, with an admirable tenacity and trickery, to see whether they could get out of this net, whether perhaps the opposite might not be true. Think as the condition, I the conditioned. Thus, I is only a synthesis which is itself created by thinking. Basically, Kant wanted to show that if we started with the subject, we could not prove the subject, nor the object. The possibility of an apparent existence of the subject, hence the soul, might not have always been alien to him. That thought which, as Vedanta philosophy, was once before present with enormous power on earth.